This is the SF Signal Podcast. I am your host. My name is Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award winner. And it's that time during your week where you tune into the SF Signal Podcast to see how long of an awkward pause I leave in after making a joke. I would like to remind you that last year you complained about the Hugo nominations and how your favorite insert genre nomination category here was utterly snubbed, in your humble opinion. And so you swore eternal damnation on the powers that be while tossing the sky a mighty fist and perhaps a finger. Well, here's the thing. If your favorite What's It didn't get nominated last year, that's completely your fault, and you have the power to change it this year. If everyone listening to this podcast right now went out and nominated and voted for the Hugos, everything would change. You're the one always talking about change on Facebook, right? Well, here's your chance. If you would like to know more about the Hugos and how the voting works, visit www.thehugoawards.org. You don't have to actually attend the Hugos or Worldcon to make nominations or vote. You can purchase a supporting membership at luncon3.org/memberships. And if you attended Worldcon in San Antonio, you are eligible already to be able to nominate people and works for the Hugo Awards. There are a lot of great podcasts out there like this one who are eligible. Heck, the folks on this very podcast today probably have something that makes them eligible for various awards. So this is your chance to affect change. It's all in your hands. I leave it up to you. Now on to our topic, tropes. What tropes in science fiction and fantasy would you like to see retired forever? And which ones do you wish were used more often? Let's go ahead and say hello to our panel. First off, we have two ladies who haven't been on in a very long time, so I want to say hello to both of them. I'm going to start with Stina.
Oh. Hi. Hello.
You've been gone for a while.
Yes, I have. I'm sorry.
But you've been productive.
I have. I have been very productive. I have a new two-book deal with Saga, which is the new imprint for Simon & Schuster.
That is awesome.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy and excited.
So you got a two-book deal, and you're going to do the advanced publishing thing and just have like one out in June and the other one out in July?
No.
No?
No.
Why not?
The first one should come out, like, not this coming summer, but the next summer.
Oh, very cool. Okay.
And it's called Cold Iron, and they're flintlock fantasies.
And what's a flintlock fantasy?
It means that I that everything is set up during kind of a Revolutionary War era.
Okay.
World.
So we have gunpowder and flintlocks.
Yes.
But also magic.
Yes.
Very cool. Okay. So not quite like steampunk, because we're not in Victorian era yet.
No, not in Victorian era.
Okay.
No. Yep.
Very cool. Well, congratulations. That's awesome.
Well, thank you.
And you still have a couple of books out right now, don't you?
Yes, I do. I have Of Blood and Honey and Blue Skies from Pain.
Very cool. And website and Twitter and all that good stuff?
My website is cslecht.com. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook, Stina Light. I'm really easy to find. L-E-I-C-H-T.
Cool. Well, welcome back. We're so glad you decided to reply to the email and come on the show again.
Well, I finally feel like I'm, you know, knew a little bit of what you were trying to talk about.
Understood. And next up, after a whirlwind tour and book stuff going on and probably some fashion blog posts and different things, we have Gail back.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm, glad the holidays are over and ready to see the new year through.
And you kind of took a break for a little while.
I did. I took a break from a bunch of stuff. I tend to try and do that over the holiday season. I'm one of those people who holes up and covers her head and screams silently to herself throughout the holidays until they end.
Yes.
I try to do this as far away from civilization and as inside as much hot water as I can manage.
And I have to tell folks, you know, I send out an email every week, and usually it's to about 40 people. It's about half women, half men. And a lot of times, even when Gail can't come on, she will still give me some sort of funny reply. And it kind of makes me smile. It's like, no, I can't do that because I'm out in the ether doing blah, 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 blah.
I have to make my excuses.
Well, anyway, I appreciate you coming on tonight. Why don't you tell folks your website and your Twitter and all that good stuff?
Oh, everything is GailCarriger.com in some form or another, and that's G-A-I-L, the proper way. C-A-R-R-I-G-E-R, like Carriger.
Why is that the proper way?
And this weird Y thing that people do in the United States, it just makes no sense to me.
That's funny. And I've been telling folks that in April, I'm going to be sort of the official podcaster at the Pikes Peaks Writers Conference. I'll be doing a lot of interviews. And Gail's one of the people that's going to be on faculty along with Chuck Wendig and Jim Hines. And there's like a bunch of people. If you go to the Pikes Peaks Writers website, you can see all the people who are going to be there. And I'm going to be doing all sorts of interviews. So that's end of April, like April 25th through 27th, I think. So if you've ever wanted to actually ask Gail some writing questions, that might be your opportunity.
It's going to be so much fun. I mean, I have sort of liminally met Chuck and Jim before, but not really had a chance to hang out with them. But I have a feeling that all three of us are sort of troublemakers just from just from knowing them on the internet and stuff. And I'm super excited about it. I think it's
you will be.
Now, Josh, have you ever been there before?
To Pikes Peak? Yeah, actually, that's where I got my first agent. Okay. A couple years back. So, yeah, pretty familiar with it. I'm not sure if I'm going to make it this year or not, though.
Okay, and by the way, that's Josh Vogt. I'm going to introduce you properly here in a second, Josh. Josh, I have heard, and I want to see if Gail has heard, I have heard rumors that there is an absinthe party.
That does sound familiar, yes. I'm not sure if I ever actually attended it, but it does sound like a familiar event. So
interesting.
At a writer's conference?
Yeah, alcohol of some sort.
Go figure.
Maybe I've just never been to a writer's conference like this one. All the writer's conferences I've been to have been hosted by universities.
Oh, okay.
So they take place
in a university department, and then at the end of the day, there's sort of a dinner on campus, and then everybody just leaves. The guests all go off to a secret location together and get drunk, but it sounds like that Pikes Peak is not quite like that.
So. No.
Don't know what I'm in for.
Yes, what I understand is that people usually don't leave, and there are parties and there's different things going on.
Yeah.
And I finally last weekend I was able to actually go to the hotel because there was a different Pikes Peaks event going on there, so I was able to check it out a little bit. And I've been offered an opportunity to go and check it out before the conference, so I kind of know what I'm doing and where I'm going and what rooms I'm going to be in for recording and stuff. So I'm probably going to take them up on that and just, you know, get to know the area. It's the hotel is sitting on like top of a hill, and there is some stuff around there, but I completely got lost. But of course, I always get lost. So, but it looks pretty neat. And from what I understand, there's lots of stuff that goes on outside of the conference hours. So,
am I allowed to feel envy?
You are.
Envy.
Anyway, so and I also I talked to Mer Lafferty because there's going to be some non-genre authors there, and I wanted to do some interviews with them too and kind of boost their signal. But obviously I can't push that out on SF Signal because it's not genre, it's not science fiction or speculative or anything like that. So I asked Mer if I did some interviews for her in the I Should Be Writing sort of style and just talk about the writing stuff. Would she be interested in hosting those? And she said, absolutely. So, Gail, I might do something with you where I'm actually, you know, serious.
Whoa.
I know.
Patrick, you could break something.
Yeah. I know. Wouldn't that be a trip? Anyway, so the other two guests tonight, panelists, I also haven't been on in a while. And I did want to talk to them as well. Josh, you have been just super busy. Now, Josh Vogt. I know some stuff about you. I'm wondering, can you officially on the podcast talk about anything hugely going on
in
your life?
Yes, I can say
you can. Awesome.
A little bit, yeah, okay. A little bit. I can't give too many details, but I can say that I have signed a contract with Paizo for what will be my debut novel. If you don't know, Paizo is the publisher of the Pathfinder Tales role-playing game, and they've got about 20 or 22 tie-in novels for them as well. And
Tim, you're going to join the ranks of Tim Pratt, Howard Andrew Jones, James Sutter, all these folks who have been writing these books.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm really stoked about it. I've gotten I have the manuscript finished at this point. I've got it out with beta readers. I'm getting feedback that's really positive. And then it will, you know, I'll get it polished up and over the next few months. I don't have any sort of official date. It could be either later this year or early next. But yeah, really excited about that. I've had a couple short stories published with them. And it's been really great so far. So very exciting.
Josh, that is awesome. And congratulations. I'm sorry, what?
I just said congratulations. That's great.
Thanks.
And I tell you what, Josh works very hard, and I see him at all these conventions locally. He's always, you know, networking and talking to people, and he's honing his craft and working hard on his writing. So this is awesome, Josh. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Next up, let's say hello to Mr. John Stevens.
Yes, I am the least significant person.
No, I'm still here. So.
I am a writer, but I've only had a few short stories published so far. I think I'm much better known for writing large amounts of nonfiction, mostly on SF Signal. I have a...
That would qualify you for a fan writer award. What?
It would
what?
Qualify
who said,
me.
What? Who said
think,
that?
You know,
who said
you that? Think someone would get on that or something. But I've been writing for SF Signal for 3 years now, I think, at least. Mm-hmm. The Bellowing Ogre column. And I write reviews periodically as well. And I had taken a little break over the holidays. I'm just getting back to getting the column revved up. And I am working on two books, a nonfiction book on reading Fantastica, and a fiction book on anarchists who destroy an empire. And that's me.
Very cool. And thanks for coming on again. Now, you've also been busy with, I guess you have some sort of other podcast. I haven't heard any details about
it. Oh, that thing, yeah. Me and the old guys podcast. Yes, yes.
Yeah, is that live yet? I mean, are you guys doing anything with that? I mean, I haven't heard a single thing from any of you.
We would have to ask the Overlord about when that's going to happen. We actually just recorded another Three Horsemen podcast. I will actually put in a quick plug for the Three Horsemen, which is a fraternal podcast, I guess, to this one on SF Signal. And is me, Jeff Patterson, and Fred Kish.
Like I said, it's first I've heard of it, so I don't know.
Oh, poppycock, I say, poppycock, man. we actually just finished recording early in the week, and decided to talk about Warren Ellis this time.
So
long, long conversation about Warren Ellis and science fiction.
So I just want to say, for the benefit of the listeners who can't see my Skype screen right now, I have a picture of John Stevens where he's kind of got an eyebrow raised and he's looking very serious. I've got a picture of Gail Carriker with a teacup raised to her lips, and so you really only see her eyes. And of course, she's got her signature gloves on her hands. I don't think that's actually Stina in that picture.
No, that's not actually me.
Who is that?
That's from Practical Magic.
Okay, so that's Sandra Bullock.
Yeah.
Okay, and then I've got Josh, who is just smiling. He's got this huge grin on his face, and so it's a nice stark contrast.
He's just happy to be here, folks.
I guess so.
I am.
So let's talk about tropes now, Josh. Why don't you go first this time? I'm going to let you go first because you got your first book deal. You're all excited. You're full of that energy, you know, and so I want to help you burn that energy a little bit. So what tropes in science fiction and fantasy would you like to see retired forever, and which ones do you wish were used more often?
Well, I can answer the retired forever one pretty easily. I have three of them: prophecies, portals, and self-indulgent character resurrections. Those are the big three that always irritate me when they're used poorly, I would say.
So you're trying to put Marvel Comics out of business?
Pretty much, yeah. It's kind of the reason why I don't read much comics these days anymore, is because I'm so tired of them bringing characters back all the time. Nobody ever dies. There's no consequences and that sort of thing. But you also see that in some books. Like in college, I actually read, I hate to say it, but I read a lot of R.E. Salvatore. And... you know, it was a tie-in to the Forgotten Realms and that kind of gaming system. But there was just a point where this character dies and sacrifices himself, and it's this big moment. And then the next book, he just pops up again with, you know, kind of a handy resurrection spell. And it loses all impact. And so that sort of thing always gets me. And that'll turn me off to a story in 10 seconds flat if I read that. But the other two, like portals, I find a little bit of a troublesome, tricky thing, because you have, it's kind of like you have the person, the author creates this magical, mystical world over here that's all full of all sorts of wonder, and then you just have the mundane, normal, you know, earth over here, and they find just some arbitrary way to link the two just to kind of get the story started, and it doesn't really have any impact other than, well, you could almost cut off the beginning part where they're in the normal world and just start out in the magical one, and it'd be fine. And then Prophecy, I think a lot of people see that one, just the idea of the chosen one, the person going on the quest to defeat the Dark Lord, because that's what they were born to do. So those are my big three, I would say.
Okay. What about, is there anything you wish you'd see more often?
I can't point out a specific trope that I would like to see more often. I would just say that I like seeing the subversion of tropes, because I think tropes in themselves are all about expectations, just because they're such a familiar thing that the moment one appears, you know, on the screen or on the page, you just go, oh, I know what's going to happen next. And the real delight in storytelling these days, for me at least, is taking those expectations and mangling them and mashing them and flipping them around and finding ways to bring something unique to it, even if that trope is still in play. So, for instance, a name everybody's going to recognize is Brandon Sanderson with his Mistborn series, and it's been out long enough. I'm sure most people who are listening to this will know it. But he starts out with the idea that you have the chosen one who goes on the quest to defeat the Dark Lord and save the world, and he fails, and the world falls into this millennia of, you know, an evil empire basically, and that was one of the reasons why I became such a big fan of his in the first place, because he totally caught me off guard with this absolute, you know, 180 degree flip of the prophecy trope. So that works really well for me.
All good stuff. Now, you mentioned mundane world, and mm-hmm. I got in trouble today because I called my marketing assistant a muggle. Because I mentioned jelly babies, and she had no clue what that was. And I said, well, Doctor Who, and she had no clue what that was. And I said, you know, from the episode, the series that's been on for 50 years, and she had no clue. And I said, you're a muggle.
Even if you don't know what a muggle is, it doesn't sound like a nice word.
I know. And then I had to explain what a muggle was because she didn't know Harry Potter.
Oh.
So.
All right, yeah. Then.
Well. Well, that's all good stuff. Gail completely disagrees with you. Go ahead, Gail.
I do? Well, I mean, no, actually, this is interesting because I think part of what we didn't do was define what we mean by tropes.
Okay.
And so I think we're going to get a perspective onto the individuals in this conversation and their thoughts on tropesness. But so, for example, my biggest I can't frickin' stand it trope, under my definition of it, is the hero's journey. Mm. So if I never see another movie or read another book where it's one dude against the universe, I will die a happy person. I am so done with that. And every component of it.
Can I cheer and clap?
And if that dude happens to be a pretend female where she thinks, acts, talks, and behaves like a man, I actually will scream and throw the book across the room. So those are my two biggest ones.
So you don't like when they write a character and then they think at the last minute, oh crap, I only have men in this whole book. I better change one to a woman, and that's all they do.
Yeah. In fact, I call it skinning. Ooh. And you can do it in the reverse direction. There are some examples, and I'd make a case for this if there were a really good book about the heroine's journey out there, but there isn't one, so I only have 4 years of classics and gender studies to back me up. But trust me, for example, Harry Potter is actually a female journey that he goes on. He isn't really a hero's journey. He's a heroine's journey. So skinning can happen. He basically thinks, acts, talks, and behaves like a woman in most archetypes. But so skinning can happen in either direction. You can have a man who's behaving as a woman by archetype qualifications, and you can have a woman who behaves like a man. So, but it's the hero's journey that I'm just tired of. I'm exhausted.
Now, you brought up something that I'd love to get your opinion and Stina's opinion on, because you both have series out there and books out there. What do you think about Rowling coming out and saying that she now regrets Ron and Hermione?
I think it's a little strange, but I mean, I don't know. I think every writer, I mean, it's been like a decade or more. I mean, every writer sort of second guesses themselves eventually. And sure. I'm sure it was just some offhand comment she said, and that now if you went up to her, she'd say, well, I regret not making Ron gay or something. I don't know. Like, I don't, frankly, the series is done. I think it stands as a series and it defined a generation, and it's time to move on to other books. Not that it's wonderful, but like, I feel like why do people keep picking at it?
It's already written. It's done. It's over with. They made movies from it. It can't change. It's not like, once upon a time I had a neighbor who read the first book that I wrote and came to me and said, "You have to change this." And I'm like, "Dude, it's published. It's done. For six months, if I walked out to my car, he would stop me and go, "You have to change this." I'm like, "That's not how publishing works."
Did you eventually just say, "Look, Mr. Lucas, I can't do that"?
I had somebody write me a legitimate email where they were so upset by the ending of the second book in my series, which is a cliffhanger, right. I mean, the story ends, but there's a romantic cliffhanger that they insisted in this email that not only should I change the ending, but I should recall all 100,000 copies or whatever. Like, it showed such a complete, insane lack of grasp of the way the publishing industry worked.
Wow. That
I can't even respond to this email. Like,
wow.
So, yeah, it's pretty crazy.
It's like it's like they think you're Toyota and you can just, pull the cars back.
Do a factory. Besides, I really like my cliffhanger ending. So I was like, I have a real soft spot for the second book of my series, which is everyone's least favorite because it's kind of breaks a lot of tropes and fractures a lot of molds, which, meant me as a writer was having fun with it. So a couple of other tropes that I really don't like are female main characters without their own agency. So there's a lot of series which shall remain nameless, a couple of which are very, very popular, and a huge plethora of romance novels wherein the woman, the things occur and there's a story, but it happens to her. So she's kind of this vessel into which the story is poured, and she has no kind of will or movement of her own. And that's another. I give up on those books.
So almost like the story. Oh, go ahead, Josh.
I was just going to say that's a huge issue for any character. It's just characters who are blown around by events and never make choices or actions on their own.
Right. Sure.
I agree. I keep finding it in young adult literature with female main characters in particular, mm-hmm. and it really frustrates me, and I just will usually give up on books.
Mm-hmm. You know what frustrates me?
I purposely toyed with that idea though. In my first series, I purposely did that because the whole "thou shalt always have agency every freaking second" thing is an American thing. It's
Well, there is an aspect of being swept away in the kind of almost Miyazaki sense of that, where, I think there's some excellent literature out there where people are drowning under their circumstances.
Yes, but my main character is male, it's very rare for a male character to get swept up in events around them. And so that was one of those tropes that I was purposely screwing with.
Yes, well, that's the other thing. And I mean, I think speaking as a writer, you have to be thoughtful about this as a general rule. Like, I will pick up and play with tropes, and I enjoy them immensely. I'll also pick up and play with stereotypes and stuff with the sure knowledge that I will eventually break them. And sometimes I won't break them for several books. But I also have to be accepting of the fact that I'm going to turn off certain readers like myself who don't trust me enough to realize I'm going to break those tropes, or for whom the mere presence of that trope is a major turnoff. Mm-hmm. And so as a writer, that's a risk that I'm willing to take under circumstances with certain tropes. But I think it behooves writers to be aware of their own actions when they're taking those kinds of risks. And so there are some books that I'll read, and I'm a real quick dropper of novels. I don't have the time to spend. And where if there's something about the writing or there's something about the author that I don't trust if they start putting tropes that I dislike in there, I'm not gonna, they haven't won me over, and I'm just not gonna finish the book. So, I mean, I'm speaking on this podcast as a reader, not as a writer. So I'm kind of talking about things that just wouldn't hold me. So the agency thing is just one of those. And it may be seen as right. Maybe I'm just very American about it.
Which would be very not Gail.
I know. I mean, some tropes that turn me off, like in romance, there's very specific tropes, and I call them the six Austins, because if you've read Austin's six main works, you pretty much know every romantic trope that every romance novel writes about. And I think, because you know, Emma is a boy loved a girl, but the girl is ignorant of it. Mansfield Park is the girl has loved the boy, but the boy is ignorant of it. Pride and Prejudice is the boy and girl meet and instantly dislike each other. Sense and Sensibility is boy and girl meet. Perfect for one another, circumstances tear them apart. Northanger Abbey is the girl willfully misunderstands the boy, and the boy's intentions and persuasion is the girl and the boy have a past and mistakes have been made that have to be rectified. And every romance novel is going to be one of those six, basically.
It's like you've studied this.
I love this kind of thing. But the key when you're thinking about, like, for example, those romance novels is a lot of science fiction books have romance, or fantasy books have romantic threads in them. So when you, as a writer, are putting a romance thread in your sci-fi fantasy book, you need to be aware that there are romance tropes as well that are going to come into play. And you should be conscientious and thoughtful about that and whether you're going to break them or twist them and that kind of thing. So when I'm reading fantasy or sci-fi and there's a romantic thread through it and I don't feel like that's been handling with consummate skill, that will also turn me off from a lot of books. So I mean, and then there are other things I like. Like if I feel like it's going to be a tragic hero story and there's going to be an unhappy ending at the end of the book, I'm not going to commit to that. I don't like leaving depressed, and that's just my personal taste. So,
that's another one of those that I played with. I purposely.
Well, and Stina,
because again, it was an American thing to expect all endings must be happy.
Well, and Stina, why don't you talk a little bit about your thoughts on this? I mean, what tropes would you like to see retired, and which ones do you wish were used more?
Well, like the others, I really do. I am sick to death of the one who shall save everyone.
No. Zathras knows. Not the one. No.
I get so tired of that. I mean, it's like every single comic book movie seems to... Yes, he's the one person that can. He's a white dude. He's a white straight dude that's going to save the world. This is why I'm going to go ahead and say it. It's going to upset many people. I don't like Doctor Who. This is why I don't like Doctor Who, because it's the white straight guy saving the planet.
I was out there saying that they had an opportunity to do something really, really cool with this regeneration, and they completely and utterly blew it.
That's the main one.
So with you, I've watched Doctor Who since the sixth Doctor, and I stopped with this last regeneration because I am tired of a white guy. I was basically like,
the chick is his sidekick, and she's always stupid, and she always does the dumb things. I can't watch Doctor Who. I've never been able to watch it. I'm sorry. So I hate the one. I can't stand the one. The other one I'm really kind of tired of is the, oh, woe is me. I am a white male who's been bullied, and now I have like all of the superpowers and all of the world, and now I'm going to be perfect and in every way, and I'll never make a single solitary mistake ever.
So did you like Creepy Stalker Superman?
There are aspects of that I liked. Yes, there are things that I liked about it, and then there are things that I did not like about it. So my feelings, I actually don't like Superman at all. He's my least favorite superhero. Sure. Not that I'm into the superhero thing all that much anyway. I like Batman, honestly, and I don't feel like he counts because he doesn't have superpowers, although he is very, very filthy, stinking rich, which actually is kind of a superpower when you think about it. But I don't like Superman at all for that reason. And also Cap bothers me. because both of them have very nationalistic sides that I find problematic.
Well, yeah. and that's baggage, probably. I mean, come on, Captain America. It's baggage from when he was created and why he was created. Because if you go back far enough, you will find comic books where Batman and Robin are fighting Nazis.
Yeah. True. But, okay, and so another trope that I really wish would die is that every single female character must equal romance. I'm so done with that. I'm so done with that. Why do they always have to be the romantic interest of someone? Can we not have female characters that actually don't end up kissing somebody? Can we please have that? I mean, we have plenty of male characters that don't.
Can I interject really quickly? Because I feel this so completely. I'm so with you. And I have this incredible soft spot for the movie A Knight's Tale, which is a pretty darn terrible movie. But he has this awesome female friend, and she's just that. And she doesn't sleep with anybody. She's not into him. She's not into anybody else. She doesn't sleep with any of the friends. And for that reason alone, I love that movie.
Yeah, and she's the blacksmith, too,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah. Oh, thank you. And
there's so many terrible things about that movie, but that was a good thing.
That's the only movie I can name off the top of my head that does that. Mm-hmm.
So I'm ready for that to die. It's like if a woman walks on screen immediately, some man's going to go, oh, yeah, she's hot. I'm all over that. And like they end up kissing every time. Every time she ends up with somebody. It's like that's the only function women serve on.
Even when the story like sets them up as being empowered and being strong and being capable all on their own and all that kind of stuff, and they spend like the whole book or the whole movie proving themselves to some degree, and then at the end you have the token, oh well, we actually have feelings for each other. It undermines everything you've built up to that point with that character.
Which reminds me of another one I can't stand. Red Sonja. Oh. That one can die. Oh, I'm so empowered, and I have all this stuff on the ball, but please, can a man take my sword away from me and beat me to prove that he's more manly than I am or something? Oh, I hate that.
even with Gail Simone writing it?
I don't know. I haven't read that, so.
Okay. Yeah, Gail Simone was doing The Batwoman for a long time, and mm-hmm. now she's writing Red Sonja.
I'm just saying that's the aspect of Red Sonja I hate.
Gotcha. Well, is there anything that you like that you would like to see more of?
More women in leadership roles.
Okay.
I'm pretty good with that. I'm pretty okay with women, you know, handling the guns and the fighty stuff, because I like that stuff. It's what I like. And I do, in fact, like, I want to see... So there are aspects of the quote unquote strong female character that I like. I do like seeing women driving the race cars. I do want to see more women doing those sorts of things, but I don't want that to define them. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I'm all about subverting tropes myself. Tropes and stereotypes. I love subverting those.
So, Stina, did you hate the Buffy-Angel relationship?
Yeah, I kind of did.
Because thinking about it, that probably falls into what you're talking about. You know, definitely a strong female character who's got all this power, and yet she still relies on Angel.
Yeah, I did kind of hate that. But at the same time, there's that whole good guy, bad guy thing, which is a total trope that I love and I'm a sucker for. I just am. I love that.
Okay.
But you know, yeah.
Also, Patrick, can I point out something just in the nature of the question that you just asked, which is that another trope, which is peculiarly American, I would argue, or at least Western culture, is that strength is being able to do something alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a significant definition of strength.
Yes.
And if you can't get it done by yourself, then you're somehow weak. If you, that the act of asking for help is a weakness. And that's a trope that I particularly loathe as well. It's part and parcel with the hero mythos. But
I agree. There's this idea, this concept that strength has only got one definition, and that was an argument that I got into when those other books came out. Was people were like, "Oh, he's not a strong character." I'm like, "But resilience is strength." Being
true, and also one of the themes that I trot out and try and write into every book that I write is that friendship and loyalty is strength. So
absolutely.
I like to write characters that build friendship networks and sort of surrogate families and then utilize them and identify that other people have abilities that the main character maybe doesn't have and kind of sort of in a general kind of way, as in a leader general, martial
absolutely. Troops. And maybe that's a female thing that we value that more. I don't know, but
That is a pinnacle quality of a heroine's journey, is that women activate networks when they're on a heroine's journey in gender mythology studies. So, I mean, if you talk to a mythos person, they would say yes, that is a defining feature of the heroine. But for me, I that's something I look for in books is whether the act of asking for help is perceived by the writer through the pages as a weakness or not.
Very cool. Well, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Stina and Gail show.
Sorry.
This has been
sorry. Awesome.
No, no, I'm teasing. No, this is awesome stuff. I don't know how John Stevens is going to follow it.
Neither do I. but I guess it's my turn.
It is. Oh, yes.
I think it sounds like everyone else had the Hero's Quest on my list.
Yes, it sounds like the Hero's Quest is not favored, but I don't know how they're going to do something different at this point, because that tends to sell so well in with a lot of this stuff. It's what sells that kind of defines what continues on. So I don't know. Go ahead, John.
Well, right, and a lot of the things we are talking about are where we don't like because they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot swing a dead cat without hitting, you know, a chosen one or something.
Well, and it's something to be said about, and it's not just publishing. I mean, it goes into television and radio and music and everything. But when something is a hit or when something becomes popular, you get 10,000 clones.
Mm-hmm. That is how you get a chosen one, though, is go around swinging dead cats. I'm pretty sure that's a good strategy.
Although I have to say, officially,
it's the SF modern Signal, era's Excalibur.
Yes, but I do have to say, officially, SF Signal does not condone the swinging of dead cats.
Whoever can pull this dead cat from the stone,
or in Colorado from the stoner.
But I'm bump.
John, go ahead.
So anyway, folks. But something that I think Gail said about. Because this is one of the things that I like adversely, is that I think we do need more stories where people cooperate, where people work together, and where people do things in a complementary manner, like build on their sort of bring their individual abilities together and do things. And that's it's funny we mentioned this because that's a big part of the novel I'm working on right now. And it's hard. Actually, what I'm kind of finding out is that it's so easy to write a hero's quest, and it's much harder to write something where you've got, say, six characters who are basically lead characters who are working together in some capacity.
Well, and then if you try to submit that to one of my critique groups, they'll tell you you've got too many characters.
Well, too bad for them. I mean, what?
Yeah, no, my project is same way, so we're working on similar sorts of things.
Right. So there was that. Another thing that I'm actually going to disagree with people on, but I'm going to try to qualify it, is that I'm getting kind of tired of subversion of tropes.
Ooh.
I would kind of like to get past the tropes and make some new tropes.
Could that in itself be a trope?
The reinvention of tropes could theoretically be a trope, indeed. And what got me thinking about this was I just finished reading Alan Moore's biography. Or quote-unquote biography. It's really an oral history that someone put together of all of the things he says. And a lot of people talk about, you know, how Moore has turned into this incredible curmudgeon who spits on comics and stuff.
Oh, I've said he's batshit crazy at this point.
Right. But I disagree. I mean, well, okay, he may be, but also, in addition to being crazy, he has a point. And the point is that certain kinds of subversion have become essentially normal. They become normalized and are kind of exciting and expected by readers. So they're not really subversions anymore. If a subversion doesn't disquiet or surprise the reader, it's not a subversion. It's just a reutilization of the trope in a slightly different way. And one of the things that I'd like to see happen more is people really try to break the mold more. And actually get away from some of the basic tropes that we use. Like time travel, I think, has just pretty much been done to death. Mm-hmm. Aliens as Others is one of the most terrible SF tropes that has been done to death. And a couple of more recent ones are decaying cities like urban entropy.
Oh, yeah.
Dystopia.
That's just been done to death.
Yep.
And we really need to think about other ways to look at cities. And actually, this is kind of why I'm looking forward, I think, to Robert Jackson Bennett's new book, City of Stairs. Because the city is something more, sounds like it's much more complex than just a city falling apart.
Mm.
Before you go further,
I'm curious because you're talking about, you know, you want to see people break out and do different things. And this is something that's echoed again in, you know, you hear this from fans of television and movies and books and music. And they're like, oh gosh, I just want something different. I just want something different. My question to the authors, both published and soon to be published. And if any of you don't want to answer the question, you don't have to. But I mean, how hard is it to convince a publisher to publish something that's different and that takes a risk and that isn't a tried and true heroic journey?
Okay, can I?
Yes, absolutely.
The current project that I have right now, the whole Flintlock thing, the Flintlock fantasy thing was something I was doing, like I said, in 2002. And I did have a short story that I was sending out, and one of the rejections that I got from one of the major magazines was, this isn't going to work. Fans do not want to see guns mixed with magic. It's hard. It's mm-hmm. hard. When you absolutely color outside the lines of what's going on at the time, it's really, really hard. What people really want, even though they say they want something completely different, what they really want is they want something different, but not too different.
Right. That still feels safe enough that they can, you know, mm-hmm. kind of sort of take a risk on it without really taking a risk.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I kind of have an analogy for tropes in my mind that I don't know. It might take a second to explain, but like, man, it may seem weird, but I think of it as like baking cakes or baking in general. You're in the same, you know, if you and someone else are baking a cake, you're using the same ingredients, you're using the same molds, you're using the same kitchen instruments and all that kind of stuff, the same cooking techniques. And it will often turn out underneath the same cake structure, even the same flavor, but it's almost like the tropes and how you deal with them are the way that you then, you know, carve up the cake or decorate it and all that kind of stuff. And that's what makes it unique in the end. You know, it could taste different and all that kind of stuff, but it's still a cake. It's still a result of the same processes, you know. And if someone says, I want a cake, and you give them, you know, a T-bone steak, they're obviously not going to be, and try and call it a cake, they're not going to be pleased with that. So, and that may be a little bit of a stretch, but
it makes sense to me.
There's other components to the situation with regards to selling the books as well. I think somebody, for example, who has a name like Neil Gaiman could pretty much write whatever he wanted. And so I do tend to think, I do hold them to a higher standard sometimes as well. Some of the gods of the field, if you would, because I feel like they have an opportunity to pretty much break and play with and do whatever they want. And so to a certain extent, they also then have a responsibility to do that.
But that's only to a certain extent, because look at what happened with Stephen King.
Yes.
I mean, when he started writing straight up literary fiction, people turned away.
True. Or J.K. Rowling. same thing.
Yeah.
You know, or
well, they liked it until they found out who wrote it, and then
yeah.
Right, right. That's why you have pen names in the first place.
And then there's also something else we have to keep in mind, which is that we're old and we're readers who've been reading in this genre for a really long time, not to mention writing in it. And we're jaded by a lot of things that the new, young, and up-and-coming readers are not jaded by because they, frankly, haven't read it before and haven't seen it before. So, for example, The Hunger Games, which we all know is Battle Royale and which we all read a bazillion different times in various 80s pulp books, but which that generation had never read before, and so it was something new and different for them. So there is that component as well.
Okay.
And this is an interesting thing because I think it affects editors in New York, because I think they are jaded by seeing the same tropes over and over and over again. And so they also forget that young readers haven't seen those tropes before. And so when a wizarding school books come across their desk, they reject it over and over again without realizing that it's Harry Potter, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. Because we've seen a bazillion wizard school books, but a whole generation of readers hadn't seen a wizard book before, and for them, Harry Potter was amazing. So there's a lot of misses in New York because of that component, because of this very jadedness that we are all a party to.
Okay. And John, so I sort of sidetracked you because that question came to mind when you were talking about that. But why don't you continue on?
Well, just to actually respond to what I was just saying.
Absolutely.
It occurs to me that maybe the changing publishing environment will begin to create spaces where we can do two things. One is get those books that she's talking about that haven't been experienced before by, say, younger readers out to them at an earlier stage, and make them much more available so that they can build that background, so that when they get to, say, more mature fiction, they're ready to try something a little different because they've seen stuff before. And the other thing is that a lot of things we're talking about in terms of not being able to get it past publishers, I think is starting to erode with the shifts in self-publishing and stuff. And it may be that some of the stuff we're talking about that we'd like to see more of can actually start to be put out that way. And I think that the problem is it's going to take a time to build a readership. But I'd like to think that there is a readership out there for that stuff, whether it's the jaded old folks or younger people who want to build on the stuff that they've just experienced.
I totally agree. Because, I mean, mm-hmm. For example, I would love to write a novella or a novel with a bisexual male main character. And New York is just not going to buy that. But
really? New York won't buy it?
No. But I know my fan base. And I know I could write it. And I would make at least my time back by just putting it up and self-publishing it. And the luxury of that option is fantastic, and is one that authors before us never got to have.
That's true.
And right. If the internet has done nothing else, it's done that for our careers, and I think that's amazing and magical.
Mm-hmm. John?
Yeah.
Any more?
Exactly. The only other one that I was going to bring up, and someone brought up The Hunger Games, was dystopia as it's currently put out there.
I'm very tired of dystopia. I really am. I'm very tired.
What I'm actually tired of are these sort of very similar dystopias where it's sort of fully formed. It doesn't seem to have a lot of space for change initially, as if somehow it's been made ironclad, and it's always very rigid and essentializing. Like the only form of utopia we seem to see a lot of is when there's like a caste system or a very rigid class system, as if that's the only way to constitute that kind of you know, governance system. I think dystopia is kind of getting wrung out, but at the same time, to go back to what people said earlier, it's also obvious that there are a lot of readers who like that, and it's actually kind of comforting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
there's a weird kind of comfort in, you know, oh, look at this rigid society that mm-hmm. does all these things. And it's not like our society at all, right?
Well, and a lot of times you can look at pop culture and see, you know, what's going on there and kind of get a feeling for it. And so, for example, they're doing a new Mad Max movie and they're doing a reboot of Logan's Run. And, you know, all this kind of stuff where, you know, the world has ended, but there's still like these little clouds of people out there, you know, that are still doing stuff. And so, I don't know. I mean, dystopian, it seems to resonate with people for some reason. And so it just keeps coming back and they keep doing it over and over and over right. and over again.
Right. But it's always fully formed, rigid, actually fairly essentialized, and often simplistic dystopia.
You know, there's distinction between dystopia and the apocalyptic, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay. They're not the same thing.
But
they're not the same thing.
No, right, they're not. I'm not talking about end of the world stuff where civilization is gone and there are zombies, you know, ice weasels or whatever.
The whole point to dystopia is that society is facing a very controlling.
All right, dystopia is supposed to be the obverse of utopia, where utopia is the sum of the perfect society where everyone has a place, and dystopia is the flip side of that, where it's a society where everyone has sort of a different kind of place.
I kind of want the ice weasel story now.
Sure, be more fun than zombies. We're not even going to get into zombies now. That's just too long of a conversation.
Although,
I'm ready for that to die too.
The Walking Dead. Exactly. The Walking Dead beat. Did it beat the Olympics? It beat like a bunch of stuff when it came back.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that comes back to, you know, what people sort of have a taste for.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd actually like to see other ways of dealing with utopia. One is watching dystopias form, like books about that.
Mm.
Rather than it's already fully constituted and ironclad somehow at the beginning of the novel.
Yeah.
I would love to see books where it actually gets formed. How does that happen? How does that process occur?
Okay.
And what does it do to people? How do people respond to it? That would be a great... talking about sort of things that flip or subvert tropes, that would be something great to see, and I don't think we've seen very much of that.
Okay.
John, you were saying, you kept using the phrase, it keeps coming back, and I feel like that's the thing with the tropes is it does. It's a cycle. It's a thing where you see... We talk about it, you know, as writers, we talk about kind of the industry, the publishing industry gets a glut of a certain trope or topic or style, like dystopian, or, you know, 5 years ago it was werewolves and vampires and all that kind of stuff. And it's a cycle of it gets out there because of one big author or two. It becomes so super popular, everybody copies it. We get so super tired of it, it fades back for a while, and then somebody does something just different enough to catch the public's eye again, and it's back, you know, and people try and catch on to the new trend.
Well, and zombies are a great example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Where zombies are in the 60s and, you know, early 70s had a wave in movies, and I think there was some fiction, not a lot, but some, and then they kind of, people got tired of them, and then they just came roaring back now in the new millennium, and now they're really like everywhere. They really are everywhere.
Well, and you said something about how, you know, you hope that the changing publishing industry will do this or that and the other thing. And I feel like that in itself is a trope, because if you've been trying to do this long enough and you've been, you know, farting around on the edges of publishing for a long time, and I won't admit that, but maybe I will. And you see all these cycles like you're talking about. It's like people always say, oh, the publishing industry is dying. Oh, the publishing industry is changing. Oh, this is happening. And it just seems like we say that, but nothing ever actually happens.
Well, right. And that's also like the death of genre narrative, right?
Right.
How many times has science fiction died? Mm-hmm. How many times has fantasy died? How many times has horror died?
And been resurrected with Joshua's Scroll.
Right.
Exactly.
And the reality is they haven't actually died. They just reform or regenerate, like, you know,
as Voltron.
Doctor Who copies
as Voltron.
Or people get tired of the same old, and then they go to a different variety just to check it out.
Yep.
Right.
So,
but then there is that generational aspect that Gail brought up of, you know, things that are, that to us, you know, are old hat.
Mm-hmm.
you know, to someone who's, you know, 15 or 18 or even 20 or 25, is new or relatively fresh and exciting or unseen before. And that's part of how things, how the cycle, I think, perpetuates, really.
Okay.
And publishers have a good, big publishers have a good sense of, I think, that generational sort of resurrection. And that's part of why they make some of the decisions they do for what gets put out there.
Mm. Okay, so I got to start wrapping this up. This is all great stuff, and I think you've all contributed wonderful things. But I do want to know as well what you're reading right now. So, John, are any books that you're reading that you want to tell people about?
I have just started Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice.
Okay, I've heard nothing but nice things about that.
Same here, so I'm very curious to read it. I just finished, I've been reading a lot of secondary material on Alan Moore, because I'm writing a what's apparently going to be in a super long article about Alan Moore based on reading his memoir.
I just did a thing on Heart of Ice, and I didn't particularly care for it.
And I'm reading a book on literacy in the United States, the history of literacy in the United States, okay, for my nonfiction book on reading.
Very cool. Stina?
I'm reading Vanity Fair right now. because I'm doing a lot of research for the books that I'm working on right now.
Did I just hear you make air quotes with your fingers?
No.
Oh, okay. No. I thought you, when you said research.
No, I am doing research. I'm doing research. And then I'm also reading Joanna Russ's How to Suppress Women's Writing.
Okay. Very cool.
So neither one.
That is a great book.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying it. Well, for giving value of enjoy. There's your air quotes there.
Josh, other than the compendium of Pathfinder monsters, what are you reading?
Actually, that's pretty accurate. I'm flipping between three different ones that I'm finishing up right now. One is Crux by Ramiz Nam. It's the second one in his sci-fi series that I really love. There's one by, I think you actually did a review of it with Jacqueline Koyanagi. Her book Ascension is one that I just wrapped up. And then I'm working through Mike Cole's Breach Zone, which is the last in his Shadow Ops series. So all those are kind of on my table.
Very cool. You know, I did have a conversation with Howard Andrew Jones, because we were talking about what goes into the, you know, building a Pathfinder book.
Yeah, he just signed on for like three more books with
them. He did, yeah. And so I was asking him, you know, do you get any materials like the Player's Handbook and the Dungeon Masters or the Game Master's Guide? And mm-hmm. Do you get any of the compendiums and all that kind of stuff? He's like, yeah, you can get all that stuff. I said, well, how many of those things do you think they would send me before they realized I wasn't actually writing a book?
Yeah.
Gail, are you into anything right now? Are you reading anything? Anything caught your eye?
I am. I actually, I read a lot more last year than I had in previous years, and I realized how much I'd missed it. Since I turned into a professional writer, I haven't been reading enough, I don't feel. So I made a concerted effort last year to read whenever I was traveling or on vacation, and I got a Kindle, and I've been using that in order to do it. And so this year I'm trying to do the same thing, but I'm trying to read kind of newer authors and books that were coming out sooner, so that if I really do like it, I can write a really good review and put some weight behind the book. So I've been trying to like follow you guys' blog and a bunch of other blogs that talk about new releases a little bit more closely. But what I just finished was not a new release. It was the Poison Study series by Maria Snyder, which has the distinction of breaking one of the tropes, which I hate, which I didn't talk about, which was the fact that most fantasy books are monarchies, and I'm tired of fantasy always having to be a monarchy. And so she wrote this, her series, which has kind of a sort of tyrannical, dictatorial military hierarchy in one world, and then like some sort of republics around it and stuff. And it was exciting for me, and the books kind of held my attention, partly because they had this break in trope, which I really appreciated in a fantasy. And I also like the main character, and I like the book, so that was good. And then right now I'm doing that thing where I'm reading a new release. And I'm reading Black Dog by Rachel Neumar, which is another young adult, which is werewolf, but it has a bunch of, I think, Mexican mythology mix into it. I haven't really explored that very much, but so that's what I'm reading right now. So I'm only just started.
I forgot to mention that I just finished reading The Coldest Girl in Cold Town, and it is awesome.
Sounds good.
Very cool. Alrighty. Well, thanks everybody. This has been an awesome podcast. Then it was The Coldest Girl in
Cold Town by Holly Black.
Town. Ooh, we like Holly. She's awesome.
She is.
Alrighty. Well, thanks to everybody for coming on. I encourage our listeners to go ahead and tell us if there's specific tropes that they're not liking right now and like to see retired forever, and if there's anything that they would also like to see used more often. Thanks for coming on, everybody. Anybody have any final thoughts they want to throw out there?
Well, I have a blog post on the tropes that I would like to see more often. I mostly just talked about the ones I didn't like, but you can look for that blog post if you want to see the tropes that I love.
Very cool.
If you search Gail Carriger tropes, it's the first thing that comes up. So
okay.
Excellent.
Stina, final thoughts?
No.
go check out Stina's website and follow her on Twitter and all that good stuff. John Stevens, any final thoughts?
I have an idea for an entire column, so that's helpful. yay.
Awesome. I'm hoping that it's at least 3,000 words.
Well, the Alan Moore piece is currently at 4,500, and I'm still going.
Good. Yeah, turn that into John 5 minutes before it needs to go live. Josh, any final thoughts?
No particular thoughts. Got to go work on a book that involves dwarves, elves, and dragons, so no tropes there, right?
Yeah, no fantasy tropes in that whatsoever, dude.
It's a good challenge.
Alrighty, thanks, everybody. Have a great evening.
Bye.
You too. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.